Boys and girls, welcome back to the Inspiration Space. Today is a really interesting episode. I recorded with Sir Bob Scott. Sir Bob Scott is a old friend of my father, so he's really from the old school. Hell of a man, you know, classifies as a British legend, really. I really love recording these episodes with people from different generations, people at different stages of their lives. Someone like Bob Scott and someone like my father, they really kind of at a place in their life where they have a great overview on what they've done, and you know, the way that certain things should be viewed, and how, you know, life is not linear, and I really love that sort of wise outtake on life, and it was very, very refreshing. So yeah, get stuck into this. It's a real goodie. He's an exceptional man that has gone through loads of different directions in his career, and he's been a massive success, obviously leading to his knighthood. And it was just really exceptional to sit with him in his house and just, you know, sit there for an hour and a half, 2 hours. We actually spoke in length before and after the podcast, and it was a very enjoyable experience for me. I hope you can take what you can from this, guys. And yeah, once again, this episode sponsor is CBD, 45CBD, and this is a company that has really, really helped me out. It's run by George Cruz and Dom Day, two ex-professional... Oh, no, actually, that's a lie. They're both still professional rugby players. And yeah, I've been using their product for a while now. It's really been helping me sleep, really been helping me with my anxiety levels, with my day-to-day, two areas that I really, really normally struggle on. And I've just noticed that it's really had a massively positive impact on my life. So yeah, guys, if you want to trial that product, which I suggest you do, do your research on it, absolutely. But what I do suggest is you at least give it a try. Head over to their website, which I'll leave in the show notes, and type in Inspiration25 into the checkout, and you'll get 25% off your next order. All right, guys, have a wonderful day and enjoy this episode. First of all, I want to say thank you so much for taking the time out to speak to me. This has been one that I've wanted to do for a long time. My father speaks extremely, extremely highly of you. So yeah, thank you very much. Firstly, I would love to talk a bit about your childhood. And we spoke about it briefly just as I came in to your house. You're an old Haileybury-ian, which is a massive thing for me, because Haileybury is where I spent 5 years of my life, and they potentially are up there with five of the best years of my life. My father calls it's a bit more like a five-year summer camp for you. So, I mean, yeah, it would be great to kind of get a little bit of background on yourself and yeah, maybe start with your childhood and we can go from there.
The thing that I think made me as a child a bit different was I was always very big. I was an enormous child. When I went to Haileybury, age 13, I was the heaviest boy in the school my first term. My voice broke when it was 10. I went straight into the choir as a bass. And therefore, I have never been bullied. I have never been anything other than slightly unusual, I think. I mean, I think I was a one-off. It may be full of myself, it may be pleased with myself, it may be, you know. But I also had a sort of slight sense that I was different, because I was big. And I also spent the years from 6 to 9 in South Africa as a diplomatic child. My father was in the High Commission in South Africa, and I went to 6 schools in 3 years, and therefore I got used to sort of being in strange situations and with new people and different, and I had this sense of being large. And so all together, I arrived, you know, at my public school, a slightly unusual person. But I was never plagued with self-doubt or anything. I was, you know, I was.
And that stuck with you forever?
That stuck with me forever, particularly in the sense that I think it's one of the great differences in generations between today's generation, your generation and my generation, is that you felt in 1960s that you were going to get a job. I mean, you didn't know what it was going to be, but you knew you were employable, you knew that life going to offer all kinds of different things. Now I think people leave school and go to university desperate to get good degrees, desperate to get, you know, onto a step ladder that really will make them, you know, rich or well off. And I never had that sense of money. I never cared about money. I never worried about a job. I went to university because I wanted to have 3 great years at Oxford, which indeed I did. I didn't cross swords with the examiners. I never sat my degree. I left without a degree.
I saw that on the little clip that I told you I watched on YouTube. I'm interested as to why. Like, why was the reasoning behind that?
Because I sort of thought all my friends are leaving at the end. I was on a 4-year course,
right,
which is unusual. And at the end of 3 years, all my friends were leaving. Actually, a sort of job was offering itself, an acting job, because I was the only thing I did at Oxford, which is sort of so people know about, is I was president of OUD, Oxford University Dramatic Society. So I was, and I had this weird and extraordinary 6 weeks of my life with Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor when they came to university to do Dr. Faustus. And I was the president of OUD, so I was the sort of senior student. I was their kind of, not their host, but I was there. I understudied Richard Burton. I mean, I've always thought one of the great moments of my life could have been when somebody stepped through the curtains of the Playhouse at Oxford and said, owing to the unfortunate indisposition of Richard Burton, at tonight's performance, the performance of Dr. Faustus will be taken by Robert Scott, you know. And I thought all these people who paid huge sums of money to see Richard Burton would have been delighted. But because I understudied him and played the chorus. But I was just kind of, it wasn't so much that I wasn't making a two-finger gesture at the university or anything. I just thought I've got everything I want out of this place, you know. I'm ready to leave. My grandmother, who was a very important part of my life, my parents being abroad a lot, I'd spent a lot of time with my grandmother, was absolutely horrified at what I did. And I remember many years later, when she was very ill and old and in hospital at age 90-something, and I went to see her in her bedroom, and I said, "Gran," I said, "you remember when I left Oxford and I hadn't taken a degree? Ah, oh, I'm absolutely shameful that you should go to university and leave that." And I said, "Here, have a look at this." And I gave her a piece of paper, which was a letter from the Vice Chancellor of Manchester University, offering me an honorary degree for my services. So I said, "Look, I got my degree in the end." And she laughed so much that her teeth fell out of the bed. I remember that vividly. And ever since then, I've picked up sort of honorary degrees and honorary doctorates.
Yeah, yeah.
I got 9.
Yeah, I was reading that on your Wikipedia profile.
I think that's exactly what somebody who didn't get a degree should do.
Amazing. I mean, even Dad got one for Bournemouth recently.
Actually. I know.
Yeah. So you've got 9.
I've got 9.
I mean, it's funny. Before you we press record, we were talking about how, and you even just said it just now, back in those days, it was a very kind of almost linear progression, wasn't it? Like, you go into a job, well, you go to university, you go to a job, and you work your way to the top of that company or whatever, or that industry or whatever you're doing. And in this snippet on YouTube, everything you said, it really identifies with what this podcast to me is all about how now life and society if you approach it in a mentality where you realise that it's not linear, you have a much better chance of surviving.
Well, I don't think we should be too... We shouldn't make rules about it. I think,
sure.
I think the answer is that I went to Oxford not knowing what I wanted to do after Oxford, but then I left Oxford not knowing what I wanted to do after I left Oxford. So I was always sort of available for sort of just anything that attracted me, because the one thing I didn't want was a job. I mean, I didn't want to sort of have something where I had to get up every morning and spend the same day roughly, you know. And even being an actor for a year, which I was, I'm quite started quite well. I went straight to into the West End and in a show that we'd written ourselves, and
which theatre was that?
Called 4 Degrees Over at the Fortune Theatre. Oh, okay. We were heralded as the new Beyond the Fringe. Well, we weren't, but we had 4 great months. Not being beyond the fringe, but the point was that I got bored doing that too, because I was living in Guildford, which is where my parents had a house, and I used to come up on the 5 o'clock train every night to do the performance at 7:30, and I had this very strong sense that I was in the empty train going from Guildford to London, passing all these trains that were going very, very full and packed and people standing, going from London to Guildford. And funnily enough, somewhere along the line, even though I didn't want a job, even though I didn't want to be categorised or pigeonholed, I also felt I actually ought to be on the train that's full of people. Because actually, one of the problems about the theatre is it does slightly, especially as an actor, it buggers up your life, which is you can't go to dinner parties on a Saturday night. You can't really choose what you do. Even Richard Burton, I realised that when I was in his midst for 6 weeks, that even Richard Burton had to sort of hang around waiting for somebody to offer him something that he really wanted to do. And you can't, I mean, you could become a great actor, and I admire great actors, don't get me wrong, but I felt to myself, I'd rather be in control of my life, make my decisions, do what I want, and just have the confidence, if that's the right phrase, that something will turn up. I'm a kind of Micawber-ish figure from David Copperfield, you know, something will turn up, and something always did.
And that was Manchester, I believe. Was that when you went to Manchester to get involved?
Yes, and that was a perfect example. I'd acted, I mean, just to prove how I never got a degree, I did 14 productions in 9 terms at Oxford. Well, that's been quite a busy actor. And one of the directors, the one I worked with most ran the theatre in Manchester, and he came up and said, would you, you know, do you want to come and sort of help be with me? And that turned into what was called the 69 Theatre Company at the University Theatre, which was a group of people who'd worked together before in 1959, but I hadn't been involved, and they sort of hired me to be a new member of this group. And we founded this company called the 69 Theatre Company in Manchester, which turned into the Royal Exchange Theatre Company. We built the Royal Exchange. And as a result of that, I ran every theatre that's ever been in Manchester, as it were, or then. But I thought I was just going up there for a couple of years, if max, you know. I mean, I didn't know the difference between Manchester and Leeds and Liverpool and Sheffield and Newcastle. I mean, I was a very either provincial sort of London home counties boy, or I was a foreign boy. I mean, I'd lived abroad. I'd lived in Egypt. I'd lived in South Africa. I'd spent my gap year in Zimbabwe. I mean, all kinds of things it sort of meant that I had a world view a bit more than just a British view. And therefore, that gives you confidence. That I think is quite important. You know, you don't feel restrained when you're like that.
The ability to adapt to different environments, so it seems to be another current theme of your career, almost, as we kind of move through it, you move into different...
You can call it adapting. I call it getting bored, which is that I love doing something for you know, 5 years or 7 years, or until, in a sense, the bit that I've decided that I really want to work on is done. I then think, well, what do I want to do now? Or I'm always available for somebody to come knocking on the door with a rather strange request or suggestion, you know.
Which I'm sure, it's funny, on my way here, I called Dad and I said, I'm on the way to see Robert Scott. And he said, did you know, if it wasn't for Robert, I would have never got my big break in Panto. Obviously, Panto being the first area of theatre that my dad really excelled in.
I think that was a marriage made in heaven, actually, because I mean, one thing that I'm not is sort of corrupt in the small sense of trying to make, and an awful lot of people used to make money at pantomime time, and they used to find a pantomime producer who would pay them a little bit on the side to get the 8 week contract, as it were.
Sure.
And your father and I never had that conversation ever. I went to see, I can't actually remember how it came about. I think he must have brought something else, a musical, and we just got on very well. And then he said, well, actually, you know, I could put together, you know, pantomime, and we talked pantomime, and he taught me of what pantomimes could do for your bottom line as well as everything else, and we were the biggest pantomime in Britain by a long way.
Manchester, or which
in
one?
Manchester,
which theatre?
The Palace.
Palace.
I mean, first of all, it had 2,200 seats, which is a very big theatre. It's one of the biggest theatres in Britain. Secondly, Manchester is a catchment area. You know, it's not a coastal town. Therefore, you've got 360 degrees of people living round you, you know. I mean, up to Cumberland, down to Stoke, you know, over to Yorkshire, over to Liverpool. You've got a really big, I mean, a better catchment area than London in terms of ease of travel. And therefore, a really big pantomime with a Les Dawson or a Ken Dodd or I can't remember all the great people we had, did very, very big. It was a big date.
Mm-hmm.
And we made it a bigger date because we actually used to sit down in, oh God, May, and work out not just who we were going to do, in which title we were going to do, but also work out, you know, why don't we do a different program? We'll set up. We had a producer of pantomimes has the ability to do 12 performances a week. Most actors have to do 8 performances a week. Pantomimes, you can get 12 performances a week. And what we did, and we worked it out ourselves, and we thought, Jesus Christ, can you do this? was instead of giving them 2 performances a day for 6 days a week, which meant they really never had a day off except Sunday, what we said was, you do 3 on a Saturday, 2 on a Sunday, then you could have Monday completely off. Now, Monday's a much better day because you could go shopping. I mean, you could go home on Sunday night. So we did 1 at 11, 1 at 2, and 1 at 7 on Saturday, and 1 at 11 and 1 at 2, and then you could go home for Sunday night and Monday night and come back for the Tuesday afternoon performance. and we made a lot of money. I mean, we changed everything around.
Changed the dynamic of the company.
We changed the amount of money. So I mean, everybody does that now.
Yeah.
But we were the first people who did it.
I've got to say that you do remind, I've only been in your presence for what, like 45 minutes. You do remind me a lot of him. You're very, your presence is very similar. It's very cool. Did you ever listen to the one I do with my dad? You should listen to that one day.
No, I never.
The way you approach situations, it sounds like it's quite similar.
I mean, I always want to be proud of what I do. Yeah. I always want to be pleased with what I do. I never want to do crap. I mean, I really can't bear crap. But at the same time, I want to run everything I do as a business. I mean, I'm one of these rather unusual people who went from the subsidised theatre into the commercial theatre. Mm. I mean, the 69 Theatre Company absolutely depended on Arts Council grants and et cetera. And it was extremely high-powered in terms of sort of intellectual content, and we were the great Ibsen Strindberg Theatre. We did all kinds of extraordinary plays, wonderful, and wonderful people like Albert Finney and Vanessa Redgrave and Tom Courtney and people worked with us, and we had a great life. We paid everybody threepence, you know. Then I moved over to the Palace and the Opera House because a big rich Manchester businessman basically wanted to build or run an opera house, and I joined him.
Mm.
And then of course we had this pantomime slot to run, and again pantomime was reducing and reducing and reducing, and people were doing 3 weeks and 4 weeks, you know, and we reinvented the 10-week run, you know. We took the show right through to mid-February, and you played children before Christmas, you played families at Christmas, you played OAPs after Christmas. And we were very flexible with prices, very flexible with groups, very good with, I mean, we made a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And on the back of what he could take at Manchester, he then had a first-class production that he could take to a smaller theatre the following year. So he did his new big productions in Manchester.
Which obviously is an extremely important city to you. Well, we can hear it from what you've been saying about it. I mean, you then, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, you moved into more sporting arenas after that.
What I did basically was, I joined the group that built the Royal Exchange, was one of the fundamental people who built the Royal Exchange. Then I moved to the Palace to build it. And it was while we were running the Palace in its first year that I realised that actually we were only skimming the surface of the audience.
Mm.
And the Opera House, Manchester is one of these few big cities with two really big theatres, two 2,000-seat theatres. And I said, why don't we try and get hold of the Opera House as well? Because if somebody else does, they'll see what we're doing, copy what we're doing and compete. Whereas we can do it ourselves. So at that point, that gave us 104 weeks of theatre to fill a year, which is much more difficult than 52 weeks. So we then went into production. So I ran the Palace as a receiving house, and I ran the Opera House as a producing house, and we put on our own, co-producing.
Mm.
So Harold Fielding would come along, Cameron McIntosh would come along, Andrew Lloyd Webber would come along. And there was a huge, series of wonderful big musicals like Barnum, like Phantom, like Evita, like Pirates of Penzance, so all these things. And we made money hand over fist. I mean, I bought the freehold of the Palace and the pub next door for 150 grand. And then I bought the freehold of the Opera House for £315,000 because the bingo wasn't working. It had closed at the theatre and would become a bingo hall. And I was actually in a building at the top of the old Granada building looking down and thinking, there's nobody going to the bingo. I could see out and there was nobody going. So I went to the owners and I said, do you want to sell? And they did. And they'd been good stewards in terms of mending the roof and all that sort of thing. But then we produced that. But having done six big productions, ending up, some with very difficult actors like Michael Crawford or Tommy Steele or Topol, or, you know, because we knew that if we were going to do Fiddler on the Roof, we had to get Topol. Mm. And that was a funny story in itself. But they were difficult, and you knew that if you, that they'd always be giving the manager a problem. So after you'd solved problem five, you knew you'd move on to problem six. So you realised the secret was never solve problem five. Just keep problem five. That'll keep you going to the end of the run, if you see what I mean. Yeah. And then you don't have to have problems seven, eight, and nine. As you were. But they were great. They were great attractors, so of course you had to, you know, work with them. I mean, one of the great days of my life was when we did Barnum at the Opera House, and it was a filthy Wednesday matinee, late January day of a 21-week run. Nobody had ever done anything for 20 weeks in Manchester. And Michael Crawford summoned me to talk to me at the end of the Wednesday back there. And I went down to the Opera House from the Palace, which is across town, which is sort of through this horrible night and dark and everything. And when I got to the Opera House, there were five absolutely identically liveried coaches lined up outside the Opera House waiting to collect their audience in a quarter of an hour's time, and they were all from East Kilbride, Glasgow. And I thought, bloody hell, if that's our catchment area, we can, you know, we really can make a hit of this. And that gave me great, and we did. The problem is that it's all gone wrong since then, and they used to be chains, and now they're chains again. In our day, they were very individually run. And you talk to your father about trying to get shows into the Palace of Manchester, he probably has terrible trouble doing it. But with me, and with other certain, you know, producers who I trusted and worked well with, we did very well. But I got bored. And I remember vividly, it was in 1984, and I was listening to the Olympics in Los Angeles on, what's his name, Terry Wogan was doing a program about preparing the Olympics. And it was the day before the opening ceremony, or the day of the opening ceremony, I think. And it was early morning in Los Angeles, but it was the end of the day in England. And I thought, why have I never heard of anybody trying to bring the Olympics to England? But why don't we talk about doing the Olympics? Nobody's done. We've done in 48. I mean, it's a million years ago, and it was post-war, and it was, you know, but what had happened in Tokyo and in Montreal and in Moscow and now in Los Angeles. And so I started, you know, just to do a little research, as it were. And everywhere I expected the door to be slammed in my face. But no, come in, what an interesting idea, you know. And in the end, I thought, right, well, I better do something about this. So I got hold of the London phone directory, which in those days was in four volumes, A to D, E to K, you know, the four. And I looked up under O for Olympic. I didn't know who I was trying to talk to, you know. And there was no reference to the Olympic Games at all under O for Olympic. There was the Olympic Cafe Kensal Rise, you know. And I thought, what do I do now? So I thought, I know, British. So I got, and there it was, British Olympic Association. That's what I want. So I phoned the British Olympic Association and I had this wonderful conversation. And I said, can I talk to the man in charge? So I said, and they said, yes, who would you like to speak to? I said, I'm afraid I don't know his name. Well, Mr. Palmer, you want to speak to Mr. Palmer? I said, fine. So could you put me through to Mr. Palmer? He said, oh, which Mr. Palmer? I said, I don't know. Well, what do you mean, which Mr. Palmer? Well, the chairman's called Palmer and the general secretary's called Palmer. So I said, well, I think I'll talk to the general secretary, actually, first. And Dick Palmer became a great mate. And the result of it all was that between 1984 and 1993, the Olympics dominated my life. I pretended I was running theatres all that time because I refused to take a... I thought it was quite wrong to take a fee for trying to get the Olympic Games. But so I had a great team. So I ran the... but we didn't get the Olympic Games. But we made a lot of noise out of it. And we got a lot of publicity out of it. And then we got the Commonwealth Games in 2002, which was a direct result of our efforts to try to get the Olympic Games. I got a knighthood, which was quite nice, which has been quite useful, which proves that basically people get honoured for failure in this country, you know, because I got knighted for not getting the Olympics rather than for getting the Olympics, but there you go. And
that's a very harsh view.
Well, I'd done other things, but it was fun. But the Olympics took over my life, and I went around the world 7 times probably in those.
So cool. What kind of stuff were you doing?
I was wooing, basically. Right. I was going to places like Mali or Niger or Barbados or Ulaanbaatar or Wellington, New Zealand. I mean, to try to get it was in those days, it was 84 members of the IOC, International Olympic Committee, dotted around the world. And you had to get to know them. And you had to get, not only did you have to get to know them, you had to get to know the shoe size of the eldest daughter. I mean, you know, you really had to get to know them and woo them and say, you know, this is the place for the Olympic Games. And we were very well listened to. People thought very well of us. But of course the problem with Britain is, like France, it is overwhelmed by its capital city. And if you bat for Britain in the name of Manchester, the immediate reaction is, why aren't you batting for London? Mm. I mean, there is only one activity in this country which is genuinely federal, where there are equal centres of strength and excellence around the country, and that's football.
Yeah, I was about to say.
You know, yeah. I mean, Manchester and Liverpool are the two, you know, great centres of football. In fact, the northwest of England quite often has you know, Bolton and Oldham and
Blackburn
and I mean, all kinds of cities. Wigan have been in the Premier League in the last few years, and you know, it's where, you know, and travelling the world as I did quite often with Bobby Charlton was one of the great joys of my life, because Bobby became a great ally. And I remember once going to Cairo with Bobby and trying to see one of the great sheikhs of Abu Dhabi, or I can't remember where he was from now. It's awful, isn't it? I can't remember exactly who it was. But, you know, there were bouncers on the door, and I said, they were having a party, and I said, could I come in and see the show? They said, you must be bloody joking, you know, keeper. So I said, well, I'd like to bring me... Mr. Bobby Charlton with me. Oh, could you just hold on a minute? And then they come back. And then we would be taken to the presence.
Wow.
You know, Bobby and I. And we and all the other chairmen of the other bidding cities, like Sydney and Beijing, right, sitting there so screaming with envy because we were getting in to see people through the, you know, the royalty of Bobby. I mean, walking around the world with Bobby was like walking around with the Queen Mother. I mean, it was just incredible, wonderful.
David Beckham of his generation, almost.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't work now, probably. No. Yeah. In fact, I'm not sure even how Bobby is because you don't see him at all. I wonder how he is, but he was a god, and he and Beckenbauer were the two greatest footballers of their generation. Mm. And he was batting for Manchester and passionately backing for Manchester and was wonderful.
Two wicked things there. I think on a personal note, I've noticed that since my like sort of change in mindset to be really open to opportunity, and I've got a very program growth mindset and trying to grow in certain areas and constantly wanting to learn and constantly expose myself to new opportunities. I've noticed that the calibre of people that I get to spend time and rub shoulders with has really gone up, and it's really exciting. It sounds like the way you've always approached life has kind of put you into situations where you can hang out with the Bobby Charltons of this world. And like, do you know what I mean by that?
Well, I had an actor friend who was very immoral and naughty, and he used to say, you can have any man can have any woman he wants. And I said, what? He said, as long as he's prepared to make a complete fool of himself, as long as he is prepared to subject himself to humiliation, he will get what he wants. And if you are going to be humble, and if you are going to be, you know, creepy, and if you are going to be, you know, for that first introduction, then you can get through most doors, you know. I've been to Buckingham Palace several times, but I've always had to sort of wheedle my way in to see Princess Anne or Prince Edward or Prince Philip or, you know, etc. etc. I mean, it's basically saying, you know, pride is not the thing to have. Once you've got there, then you mustn't be a pushover. You must then almost immediately start fighting your corner. But you start off by listening. I mean, I think the great thing, I've learned that from my wife partly, who's a psychologist, which is that she said she always makes her laugh how often she goes to dinner parties and spends the entire dinner party listening to somebody who then said, I had the most wonderful conversation with this woman, you know, in which my wife said nothing. they talked and talked and talked and talked, but they listened and they asked questions, and therefore that's one of the secrets, I think, is you start off by asking questions, by being, you know, a bit Uriah Heep like, a bit humble, and then you become the character you are. And the other thing is to spot things. I mean, if I have a claim to fame, it is actually that I am the only person who in 1993 was made Mancunian of the Year. In fact, for the second time, because I was in the 80s as well. But anyway, in 1993, and in 2003, I became Scouser of the Year. Now, nobody, and I've often said it to Bobby, I said, whatever else you do, Bobby, you will never be Scouser of the Year.
Absolutely not.
Scouser. And the reason is because I had a phone call from somebody who was looking for my advice, essentially, about how to sort of sell Liverpool, this was for the European Capital of Culture candidate, because this is back in about the year 2000, and Liverpool was sort of thinking of it, if you see what I mean. And there was also at the same simultaneously there was an effort being made by Liverpool. There was a consultancy being arranged for Liverpool, a very big consultancy being run by very big architectural companies for the future of central Liverpool, essentially the King's Dock and all the new work that being done in Liverpool. And I said, and I gave this man who was an accountant, I gave him a sort of very brief sort of summary of how I'd go about it. And he said, well, would you be prepared to join the team? Because if you joined the team of bidding for this piece of work, we would immediately look unlike any of the other bidding teams, who would just be architects and cost consultants and etc. And I said, yeah, sure, lovely, yeah, but you have to pay me. and they said, yeah, fine, yeah, absolutely. And then, as a result of that, because we were presenting to the leader and the chief executive of the City of Liverpool, they took me aside during the interviews and said, will you join us and help us? At which point, I became the chief executive of the Liverpool effort to become European Capital of Culture.
European.
And the very big two, one was in Glasgow in 1986, I think, and then in Liverpool in 2002. And then as a result of that, which is one of the ironies of Europe, actually, I became chairman of the jury of the European Commission choosing future European capitals of culture. Because one of the things about Europe is that when I started with this, there were only 9 members of the European Union. And you had simultaneous translation going on behind you all the time, sort of English into Italian, Greek into German, blah, 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 blah. There are now 29 members the European, so you can't have that. The whole business of Europe is run in English. English is the international language. Mm. So here we are, leaving Europe, and what do? We leave behind the fact that they've bloody well got to keep speaking English in all that. And that means that any committee with lots of different, you know, nationalities on the committee, if there's an Englishman on the committee, the likelihood is they become the chair of the committee, because they have to write the report and they have to, you know, they have to, and they're the people who can sort of more or less adjudicate and whether they, you know, people are understanding each other and adjudicating. So that was the period after my life of, well, the one thing I've cut out is the dome. I was brought down to prepare Greenwich in 1995. For the Millennium.
You were part of the Millennium Dome.
Absolutely. What happened? it's a very funny story. Price Waterhouse, I think it was, phoned me up and said, "Listen, you know." Because remember, I was Sir by now, and my Manchester reputation was quite big. And then he said, "Listen, we're looking for somebody like you to prepare Greenwich for the year 2000. This is in 1994.
Mm.
And I said, "Oh," I said, "how about me?" So they said, "What?" So I said, "Well, my work's done here, really. I mean, I've got the Commonwealth Games. And I don't want to stay 7 years preparing for the Commonwealth Games."
Sorry to wake up. Sorry, carry on. I'm listening.
I don't really want to stay for the next 7 years preparing for the Commonwealth Games. And my marriage had broken down, and I'd got a new wife who wasn't really as in love with Manchester as I was, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so here was an opportunity to sort of offer myself to Greenwich. And then I had this interview with this lovely guy who became a great friend at Greenwich, who said, he said, well, we've got this problem, he said. He said, at the Royal Observatory, just literally 500 yards from where we're sitting, the Royal Observatory got a phone call from Accurist, the watch people. And they said, we would like to reserve the Royal Observatory for 2 days from December the 31st, 1999, to January the 2nd, 2000. To which the person on the end of the line said, why? And they said, well, we think that Greenwich could be rather an important destination for the millennium, or an important focus for the millennium, a bit like sort of Bethlehem, really, you know, it's a place that represents time and space, and so we suddenly thought we're not preparing, we're not thinking 2000. This was in 94, so I said, yeah, fine. Then Michael Heseltine and Virginia Bottomley came up with this competition to have a place to have a huge thing and a thing, whatever it was going to be, and what they really wanted was Walt Disney to set up a kind of studio somewhere and open it for New Year's Eve 2000. Well, they didn't get what they wanted, but to cut a long story short, and it's quite well known, but it was that they chose Greenwich for the site, and they chose they decided to run it themselves, and running it themselves, the Millennium Commission, was what buggered it up. But I was made director of the effort to get Greenwich chosen as the location for the event.
Right.
And as the Greenwich Peninsula is on the Meridian Line, it seemed the obvious place to do, and you'd get a wonderful piece repair work done on a totally contaminated site, and you could have a great big thing, which is still going. And of course, the thing that's made it work was not the Millennium Exhibition, but it's the Philip Ansbach arena, which is a huge success in making lots of people lots of money. You know, so the O2. As it's still called, though I don't think that's its real name anymore. But anyway, it was the O2. So that's why bidding is my middle name, really. You know, I bid for theatres, then I bid for the Olympics, then I bid for the Commonwealth Games, then I bid for the Millennium.
It's fair to say another theme of your career life is that you are extremely persuasive. Then.
Yeah, I think.
What's the key behind that?
I think it's actually, again, listening. It is seriously being said. I mean, I'll tell you a little story why Manchester won the European Capital of Culture against the absolute favourite, which was Newcastle.
Manchester or
sorry,
Leeds.
Beg your pardon.
Leeds.
I this is a problem I have, actually.
Between the two.
Liverpool was chosen as European Capital of Culture because the government set up a very, very high-powered committee of 12 under the chairmanship of Sir Jeremy Isaacs, who you don't fool around with, as it were. And they were given the job of choosing between 12 cities that had put their names forward. And the first thing they did was they reduced the 12 to 6. So our first job was to get into the 6. Then our job was to get from 6 to 1. And everybody was saying that Newcastle was the right place because they just opening the Sage, they just opened all that sort of Gateshead, the bridge and various things, and Newcastle had a really good sort of. They said, "This is, you know, we deserve it," and they set up a PR company, which said to this committee of 12, "You have no choice. It's Newcastle. It has to be Newcastle. It's got to be Newcastle." Well, the one thing you don't say to a group of people who've got to make a choice, you have no choice. And what we discovered, and I knew from previous experience in a different life, that the one thing you want to persuade people to your way of thinking is to say how much you need it, how much you want it, how enthusiastic you are, but what a difference it made. And I made the comparison between a cup and a scholarship. Do you want the cup for victory, for everything we've done, you know, and well done, you did this, you did this, you did this, you get the cup? Or do you want to give somebody a scholarship so that they can do this, 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 and this? And of course, to intelligent people, actually giving a prize to help people do things is much more interesting than giving them a prize for what they've already done. And so we basically persuaded the committee, and we said to ourselves, this is not a matter for the national newspapers, this is not a matter for the BBC, this is not a matter for political sort of infighting. This is a decision to be made by 12 people. And we have to get to know those 12 people. And we have to know what they think and what they're worried about and what they're keen on and what they're interested in and blah, blah, blah. And we had, frankly, a team of people going
in the same direction. They understood
going
that.
And it was very, very directed, and it was very, very schematic and deliberate, and one of the things you do in that, and I learned that from the Olympic bidding process, because the other thing you have to do is you have to be, where there are several candidates, you have to be the chosen candidate of a group, maybe not a majority, but the second choice of the rest. So the ones who back you, but the ones who need to come on board are happy to back you because you are their second choice. And so I knew how to, I worked that out, as it were.
Quite an incredible career. I'm amazing the fact that you bounced between so many cities. I like to kind of always wrap these episodes up with a couple of questions. Firstly, are you working on anything like this at the moment? Or, I mean, are you not going to work on another city in the UK anytime soon?
I suppose in one sort of sense I'm always available. But I've had such a good life, and I love seeing friends. I love this part of London. I've got to know London, Blackheath, Greenwich, this corner of London very well. I'm a manic traveller. I go around the world. We go to all kinds of funny places. I'm planning a holiday in Uzbekistan at the moment, having been to Bhutan, Georgia, Armenia in the last few months, you know. And I know I can't go on doing that forever because it's tiring, and I'm 75, as they say. But I have grandchildren that I'm absolutely devoted to, and And in a way, I look at the world of social media and I look at all other kinds of parts of life, and I don't quite understand it like it is, But I was I had my time, and I think people need to get the fuck out of the way. I mean, it is other people's time.
Yeah.
And I think people who stay on into their 70s and 80s are really blocking the path and you only have to look at firms of solicitors who bring in these young investment bankers and lawyers, as it were. They're in their 20s, and good luck on them, and they'll get whacked and they'll get tired out very, very quickly. And hopefully they'll do lots and lots of different things. And I've felt I've been able to do lots of places, lots of things. So the answer to the simple answer to your question is, no, I haven't got anything else I'm doing. I'm still, I do charitable work. I mean, I do things for... I'm still chairing the Granada Foundation, even though Granada's died. It's the Granada Foundation lives on, which is up in the northwest. I'm helping other people on various projects, and I like sort of giving advice if people want advice, or talk to people if they want to, or if people want to come and talk about capitals of culture or bidding for this or bidding for that. I give them advice, but no, I'm not. Full-time anything.
Fair enough. The last question I always finish this with, before I ask you it, there was a small snippet, I keep referring back to it, that YouTube clip, which I'm going to put in the show notes of this episode because I think it was brilliant. Somebody asked you, what was the question? I don't know if they actually, you hear them asking the question, but you said, one thing that I did that I would recommend to anyone is to find someone you have respect for and learn from them shamelessly along the way. And it's something along those lines. And I just think that's such an unbelievably brilliant phrase, because I think I've done that without even realising. I've done it with my father. I've kind of...
Well, I'll answer that shamelessly, in the sense that one of the things that happens to me,
yeah,
is that people come to me and say, you once told me blah 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 blah, and I've never forgotten it, and it's been a mantra for me for the rest of my life. And I don't know who they are, and I don't know what it was I said, and I don't know what it was I did, but it was certainly something that I'm quite happy to think that I am like that. I mean, there were two people I worked for who were completely different people. One was a man called Michael Elliott, who was the real force behind the Royal Exchange Theatre, who was a difficult, demanding, rather unaffectionate man, but he was extremely bright and extremely intelligent. And I thought, listen to him, just listen to him, And then the other man was a rugged, rough-minded Manchester businessman called Raymond Slater. And I always remember when he talked to me about wanting to build an opera house in Manchester, being left alone with him in his car and discovering that on his tape machine in the car was an opera by Bruckner. And I thought to myself, this man's serious. He's not one of these people who wants glory. It's because he really loves it. And I thought, That is an incredibly good job, because if you met him, you'd think he was probably on the side of the crooks. Actually, he was rough, he was tough, he was a lot of people spoke badly of him, but actually I knew that his soul was pure, as it were. And I think they were both lessons which prove that I did do that I actually felt that, you know, people have been there before. There's nothing new under the sun, really. I mean, sure, there are inventions. Sure, people are now, you know, being born who are going to have jobs that don't exist at the moment. And you have to be ready for that. You have to learn that. And that's the difference, that the life has speeded up at an extraordinary rate. And maybe that's one of the reasons why I'm a bit of an exploded volcano. I mean, I've had my day, but my hunch is that if you listen and you imitate in the right way, then you don't have to relearn. You know, you don't have to become a watchmaker to start a watch. You know, you just have to wind the bloody watch up, and so I believe passionately that there are, you know, there are so many people I'd love to meet, but I've met so many, you know, special, wonderful people, and I think the other thing is that basically everything makes me laugh. I mean, I am a serious person, but laughing is my best thing.
And that is probably the perfect thing to really end on. I've absolutely loved this whole interview. It's been fantastic. One thing I will finish on, which is always a question I always do finish on. If you had, this may be hard because you've probably got so many, but if you had one life lesson, relatively brief, one life lesson that you've learned that you would pass on to somebody who is really sort of lacking a buzz and a fire in their belly and a direction, what would that be?
Accept the world as it is. Don't try to pretend that things are what you want them to be. Accept that things are what they are. I mean, if you are not a good footballer, don't pretend you are a great footballer. If you are not a great singer, don't take up singing. I mean, sing in your bath. I mean, all I mean by that is that so many people see the world as they want it to be rather than as it is. And the people who succeed, I think, are the people who have accepted and then maybe try to change, but they have accepted how the world is, how it works, what makes it work, and what you, how you can operate inside that.
Fantastic. That was lovely. Thank you so much, Robert. I've really enjoyed every second. And thank you once again for taking time out of your day.
Wonderful machines.